That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the mind.
American Prestige listeners, it's Derek, and I am very grateful to be joined once again by Dalia Hatuka. Dalia is a journalist specializing in Israeli-Palestinian affairs. She writes about regional Middle East issues. She's a tour de force, and she's been on the show a couple of times. We're very grateful to welcome her back. Dalia, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we need to start with an update on the situation in Gaza. It's been a few weeks since we talked about Gaza, and particularly we haven't talked about it since the start of the Israeli, the 12-day war, as Donald Trump calls it, between Israel and Iran, during which time, I think, if anything, while the world's attention was distracted by that conflict, you heard stories. I read stories with, you know, interviews with Palestinians in Gaza saying things are actually getting worse, as hard as that is to imagine, that the Israelis took the opportunity to ratchet up the violence, ratchet up the oppression in Gaza. Can you talk a bit about how things have been going there for the last couple of weeks?
Yeah.
Especially for the last couple of weeks.
Yes, of course. So Gaza is basically hanging by a thread. I'm just going to go through the humanitarian situation a little bit just to kind of give people an overview of what's going on. So, for example, like only about 40% of its drinking water facilities are working. Fuel shortages are pushing the system to the edge. Nearly every household is struggling to get enough water. And on top of that, tens of thousands of high school students, for example, haven't been able to take their final exams for 2 years running now. I know a lot of people would say, oh, you know, why are we talking about education when, you know, people are dying of famine and disease and whatnot. But, it's all in the details. And the fact is that families, you know, are risking their lives, for example, just to find food, often ending up in deadly stampedes or attacks. Adults skip meals so kids and the elderly can eat. The hunger is so bad. People are basically eating once a day or not at all. These are the kinds of reports that we're getting from Gaza. And also, unfortunately, as is the case in many situations such as these, especially, in war-ravaged places, reports of gender-based violence are rising. Women and girls are becoming increasingly vulnerable, as the UN points out all the time. And on average, I would say over 100 children, I believe the UN was saying, are being treated for acute malnutrition every single day. And so these numbers kind of give you an idea about the crisis, how the humanitarian developments are worsening by the day. Since March, for example, also Israeli forces have intensified attacks from all directions, displacing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. They keep moving one way only to be moved back into another. The overwhelming majority of Gaza is now under Israeli military control or what they call evacuation orders. People are packed into crowded, unsafe shelters. They're living on the streets. The violence has been brutal, and it's unprecedented in many ways. More than 56,000 Palestinians killed since October 2023. Just thousands just in the last few weeks. Many of these deaths happened while people were trying to get food or shelter. And even the aid distribution has turned deadly, as you mentioned, and we, you know, obviously can talk about this more later. I think it was something around 500 people reportedly shot or shelled while waiting in line for help.
So I do want to get to that, but I want to go back to something that you mentioned in terms of children who are now, you know, 2 years on without any education. I think people, you're confronted with the images of the dead, the wounded, the physical immediate effects of this campaign, and then you hear about. You hear people say this is a genocide and what's happening here is genocidal. You tend to focus on the figure of 56,000 dead, whether that's accurate or an undercount. I think it's probably an undercount, but still a massive number of people killed. But it's not just that. The long-term effects of what's happened in Gaza over, you know, approaching, I think, 21 months at this point. You're going to have a lost generations at this point. Like, not only do you have older kids, you know, teenagers who aren't in school, aren't getting educated, are going to be, you know, thrown back in that sense. Younger kids, as you said, critically malnourished, which has long-term, like lifelong repercussions. Even something that I've wanted to talk about on the show for a while and have struggled to figure out a way to bring it in and talk about it, but the destruction of Gaza's heritage, like the complete obliteration, to borrow a word that Donald Trump's been using lately, of heritage sites in Gaza, of records, archives, the history of the territory, all of this is genocidal. This is not just about the death toll or the casualty figures. It's about destroying this people in a comprehensive way, it seems like.
Absolutely. This actually takes me back into time. If we were to look at what happened shortly before 1948, during 1948 and after, Israeli soldiers or Israeli whatever you want to call them at the time, there would be a lot of looting that went on. There would be looting of archives. There would be looting of books. Throughout my career, I've spoken to many people whose fathers and grandfathers were holding on to, you know, books about Palestine and about Palestinian heritage and culture. And these were looted and they were never given back. And a lot of them are in Israel right now, with very little access to them by the people who actually own them. And this kind of takes me back to that because, unfortunately, there seems to be a repetition. We've all seen social media, posts on Instagram or what have you, with basically Israeli soldiers, again, doing the same thing, looting even rugs, anything that they could get their hands off in Gaza that they think is, you know, either important to them or interesting to them, or something that's destructive. And that's included the destruction of heritage sites, of cultural places, of universities. I mean, let's not forget about the universities that have all been destroyed. And when you talk about, you know, children not being in school for 2 years, like you said, it's an entire generation that's been lost. And maybe not a lot of people know this, but as Palestinians, we tend to focus a lot on education because a lot of the times that we don't have anything else. So that's why our parents, you know, really focused on education as a means for children to grow up and to have, you know, something meaningful in their lives. And that's why you see that, for example, before the war, the levels of education, higher education in Palestine, meaning West Bank and Gaza, where the rates were very high. And now these children are lost. I mean, all you see on video or, you know, pictures coming out of Gaza is children just basically, you know, hauling these buckets of water, being reduced to, going and begging for food. A lot of the stories that come out are horrific, where children are basically being burned by the actual food that they're waiting for, because, you know, there's a stampede. There's a lot of people pushing to get food from like soup kitchens or what have you. And the kids tend to get injured trying to get whatever scraps that they can get. And so it's honestly, I don't know if I have the words to describe it anymore, you know, because we've been talking about this for almost 2 years, and it's just, it just feels like not just the kids, you know, are lost, but all hope is lost. And this is coming from a privileged person who is not living in Gaza, so I can't even imagine what the children over there are going through.
I want to come back to the issue of these aid distribution centers. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this scheme that was dreamed up by the U.S. to take over, basically to crowd out the U.N., it seems like, from distributing aid in the territory, has created this system now where the aid doesn't come to people. People have to go to these established distribution centers, which causes crowding. It causes starving people to, you know, occasionally stray outside of, I guess, whatever designated lines they're supposed to be in. I mean, it's just so absurd to expect people to go through to jump through the hoops that this scheme requires them to do to get a package of food so they can stay alive. We've seen now the statistics from Gazan officials are 549 people have been killed near either one of these distribution centers or in areas where they were waiting for whatever remaining UN trucks are still getting through to show up and distribute aid. They've been killed by the Israelis. They've been killed by the IDF firing on crowds of people who ostensibly pose some kind of unspecified threat. Although there's just a piece today it was today in Haaretz, as we're recording this on Friday, that basically interviews anonymous IDF soldiers who are telling Haaretz that they've been ordered to just fire on these people who are gathered at these centers. It makes the Humanitarian Foundation, the so-called Humanitarian Foundation, I mean, their main responsibility seems to be kettling Palestinians on behalf of the IDF to make it easier to kill them. It's just so fundamentally absurd. Can you talk a bit about, you know, what you've heard about what's going on here, and just watching the way that this aid, you know, when they announced this thing, I know the UN questions or the UN concerns, the concerns of other humanitarian agencies was that this foundation was going to weaponize aid in the sense that, you know, certain people could be rejected or, you know, the Israeli government could dictate who gets what. I don't think they meant weaponize aid in the sense of we're going to use aid as a means to kill people. But that seems to be what's happening.
So, deadly incidents have recently become a near daily occurrence at these distribution points, like you mentioned, but they've been attracting relatively little attention outside of Gaza since Israel attacked Iran a couple of weeks ago or so. I think that, you know, UN agencies calling this an abomination and a death trap is exactly right, because what happened was Israel eased, I mean, you know, somewhat, its total blockade of Gaza just over a month ago, or it claimed that it did. I mean, it's allowing a trickle of trucks to come in. And the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began operations a few days later. Now, the group says that it has provided something like 40 million meals. If that's true, great. But you have millions of Palestinians, and you're talking about people that are malnourished, people that haven't been eating. I mean, you know, when you do the math, it's not really a lot.
Right. I mean, it's 40 million meals for 2 million people in a month total. That you start to break that down and do the division, it doesn't amount to much.
Yeah, the math doesn't math. You know, while the GHF is officially classed as a private organization, it has this opaque funding, and also it's backed by the US and Israel, both of whom, you know, Israel is the perpetrator of the genocide that is currently being waged against the Palestinian people. And the U.S. hasn't, you know, done anything to prove that it is this, you know, anything but supportive of Israel. It never, you know, tried to disguise the fact that it is arming Israel, supporting it with weapons or money or what have you. And then it brings in the armed private security contractors, and it asks the UN and major aid groups to cooperate with this, you know, foundation that's basically, you know, a bunch of mercenaries. And of course, the UN and the aid groups have refused to cooperate with it because, you know, they believe that it would essentially be cooperating with Israel's goals in the war that's now almost, you know, nearing 2 years. And the fact that, you know, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is forcing people to go past, you know, Israeli forces on the perimeter that you mentioned to reach this hub, these hubs, is a problem, because You are asking people to put their lives at stake in order, you know, to get whatever it is that they can. And you're asking people to enter combat zones, essentially, where they're repeatedly fired upon, you know, trying to access food. And it's not just, you know, adults that are being killed or injured. Children were killed or injured in more than half of the fatal attacks. I believe there were reports by Save the Children that said 10 out of 19 deadly incidents, you know, at food distribution sites involved kids. And so now, despite all of this, we hear from the U.S., we hear that the U.S. is going to give $30 million to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, despite like the violent and the chaotic nature of the rollout of food distribution. And this grant, or whatever you want to call it, makes the U.S. a direct backer of this aid organization that is essentially collaborating with the Israeli government. And so we've already heard from the State Department. It says that, or it said that, it has already distributed $7 million to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and this basically makes, you know, this organization's mission more and more politicized, and I think that honestly, if there's anything we should, and by we, I think, you know, also as Americans, we should look back into history and figure out why these humanitarian, the so-called humanitarian work being used or being done, actually, or undertaken by U.S. mercenaries has never been, you know, a good thing. Like, this approach backfired in the past. There are many examples of this. If you recall, you know, Iraq, Blackwater, and the fallout of security aid, quote unquote, you know, after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, there was another case of this happening where private military contractors like Blackwater, now called something else, I forget what it is, they were hired to protect U.S. officials and secure convoys and even guard humanitarian missions. But in 2007, they opened fire in the heart of Baghdad, killing 17 Iraqi civilians, including women and children. And so the bottom line is what's the U.S. isn't essentially learning from its own history and what's meant to be, a protective arm or an arm that provides humanitarian goods and services, let's say, is essentially being turned into a PR and a political disaster that damages the credibility of these humanitarian efforts. So it's really hard to not look at the GHF and think of these situations in the past, like Iraq, Haiti, and South Sudan.
I want to switch places here and talk about something that we really haven't talked about in a while on the show, to our shame, which is the situation in the West Bank, which has been under the radar, not just the last couple of weeks because of Iran, but it's been under the radar given the situation in Gaza for months now. But we've seen the IDF move into the northern West Bank and essentially implement a Gaza light program of emptying out refugee camps, you know, basically saying we're never going to let people back into these things. We're going to destroy them and build something else. Besieging entire cities, entire towns, surrounding them, you know, limiting what gets in and comes out. We've seen upticks in settler violence. There was just, in the last couple of days, a settler mob that killed, I think, 3 Palestinians in an attack. So what's been going on in the West Bank? Give people sort of a general update of what's been happening there and where you think this is leading, because the issue of annexation becomes a much more salient thing. Not that there aren't people calling for the annexation of Gaza, of course, but really in the West Bank, that's the watchword, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, the world is focusing right now on, you know, Israel's conflict with Iran, and that's kind of given Israel more of an opportunity to continue its expansionist project in the West Bank. So, you know, while our eyes are on Israel, Iran, the missiles flying, leaders calling for calm, everything that's happening in Gaza with people being killed while trying to access food aid, just a few kilometers away from Gaza in the West Bank, things aren't really any better. So I believe since the war with Iran escalated on, June 13th, Israel has locked down cities and villages, blocking roads, setting up more checkpoints, access to a lot of Palestinian villages in the West Bank have now become almost impossible because you've got these gates that have been placed outside some of these villages, and these gates are operated and controlled by Israeli soldiers. Essentially, creating kind of like an open air prison. And it's made life unbearable for the 3.2 million Palestinians who live there. And the thing is this isn't just about security. It's part of a larger pattern. So Israel is continuing to do what it's been doing, which is to destroy infrastructure in the refugee camps that you mentioned and gradually take over land in the West Bank. And the aim is clear, because this has been the aim from the get-go, which is to entrench this apartheid-like situation on the ground, make sure there's no viable future for a Palestinian state. And it's not just Palestinians who are worried. I mean, if you look at Jordan, which borders the West Bank, it sees this as a threat to its own stability. And I believe, you know, Israel is at the moment trying to build more fortifications along the Jordanian border. And, you know, the Jordanian political echelon is worried, understandably. But to go back to your point about the what the Israelis have called the Iron Wall operation, the military operation in the West Bank, it was launched in January. Entire refugee camps have been targeted with airstrikes and drones, which is something that has rarely been seen in the West Bank since I lived there in during the second Intifada in about 2000, the year 2000. And since this Iron Wall operation has been unleashed, there's at least been 40,000 people who have been displaced, although I think that's an undercount because more and more people are leaving, even from the towns that surround the refugee camps, because the Israeli soldiers or Israeli forces haven't just focused on the refugee camps, but they've also started to go into cities proper like Nablus, Jenin City, and whatnot. And of course, you know, Israel says it's going after militant groups, but what's really happening fits into a broader push by the Israeli far right, which is to take over as much land as possible and push Palestinians out. And this is where you get this vision of a greater Israel coming in, an Israel that stretches beyond its current borders. And it's being built step by step. And that's always been Israel's modus operandi, because it's easier that way. When you do it like step by step, you can have the Europeans, you know, clutching their pearls and the Americans, you know, condemning it. But at the end of the day, it's happening, and it's happening slowly but surely. And so you have all these military raids, home demolitions, road closures. They're all being used to empty out Palestinian communities. What's essentially also being used to legalize the takeover are the laws that are also helping. Some of the laws, for example, that were passed in May, there was this one particular law to seize Palestinian land and property in Area C. Area C is essentially the largest area in the West Bank, and it's the breadbasket of the West Bank, and it's where 300,000 Palestinians live. And then just, you know, a few kilometers, close to that, you've got East Jerusalem. Talking to people, their homes are either being destroyed or taken over by settlers, or they are being pushed into destroying their own homes under the guise of not having the proper permits to build, when these permits are never given by Israeli authorities to begin with. And finally, I'll just say that, and I feel like I constantly say this, but for Palestinians in the West Bank, the future is looking increasingly bleak. I didn't know that we could, get to that point, but we always seem to be at that point. The towns and cities in the West Bank are being sliced up. The economy is falling apart. The Palestinian Authority, which has long been struggling to govern, now looks like little more than an arm of Israeli security. I mean, not just now, it's always looked that way, but it's just increasingly becoming, or looking to people as if it's just a puppet and it's not really doing anything to help people when their lives are falling apart.
So I wanted to ask about the Palestinian Authority. I wanted to do it maybe in the the context of generally political entities, not just the PA, but governments in the region seemingly collaborating with the Israelis. You mentioned the government of Jordan is worried about the possible annexation of the West Bank. It's worried about what the Israelis are doing. At the same time, like, it was protecting Israel for the past 2 weeks from Iranian air. Like, they were activating their air defenses to protect Israel from Iranian airstrikes. It strikes me as a strange relationship at this point for the Jordanians, who just seem to be knuckling under in a very subservient way to the Israelis, in a way that is familiar for people who've watched the Palestinian Authority. And of course, the PA now has Mahmoud Abbas has finally named a vice chair of the PLO, presumably as a designation of his heir apparent. So talk a little bit about just how the Palestinian Authority and Jordan and the what we've seen from the other governments of the region over this past while and the relationship that they have with the Israeli state.
So, the Palestinian Authority, as always, is stuck between a rock and a hard place. So, on the one hand, they've had to denounce Israel's military campaign or whatever you want to call it in Gaza. They've called for ceasefires. They've criticized the civilian death toll. But on the other hand, you can't but help, you can't help but see that Mahmoud Abbas, the PA president, is always looking for an opportunity to blame Hamas to kind of paint Hamas in a different light from what a lot of Palestinians would see Hamas as. So, for example, in April, he directly blamed the group for justifying Israel's actions. But at the same time, he goes and he slams Israel's violence and humanitarian impact. So the PA has had to walk a tightrope. So it's criticized Hamas's tactics, especially around the Israeli hostages. I don't know if you recall in April, Abbas had this speech, and of course, you know, he never misses an opportunity to kind of drop this diplomatic mask that he has on. He referred to Hamas members as sons of dogs, and he demanded that they release the captives. And of course, you know, Hamas rejected his words, and they said it was insulting and whatnot. But at the end of the day, the PA looks like it's essentially doing Israel's bidding. Because while a lot of people are criticizing Hamas for October 2023, at the end of the day, people are also outraged. They're horrified by the genocide that's unfolding before them in Gaza. So the focus has kind of shifted. And so that's why the PA is still stuck, you know, talking about Hamas, people have kind of moved on and they're like, okay, but what do we do now? People are dying. Children are being shredded to death in these attacks. People are malnourished, all the things, all the horrible things that are happening in Gaza. So that's the focus. And so the picture is that, you know, the PA is trying to kind of align with Palestinian public sentiment, but at the same time, it's risking angering Israel and the U.S. And the fact that it's criticizing Hamas, it's trying to show moderation to its Western allies. But this, at the same time, strains its relations with Hamas and weakens the PA's legitimacy, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. And it fears distraction from, like I said, you know, the Palestinian plight. And so what does this really tell us about the PA? You know, as usual, it's politically split. It's trying to reconcile international support, especially from the US and the EU, with domestic Palestinian expectations. But the problem with the PA is that it's always been reactive and not proactive. So PA leaders, you know, talk about ceasefires and aid, but they haven't led any kind of robust regional strategy. And so it's on an uncertain footing. So, you know, the domestic support is weakening, U.S.-Israeli alignment is tightening, and so the PA is risking losing both relevance and authority, not just internally, but also internationally. Now, with regards to Jordan's position, I think Jordan is also in a very precarious position because ultimately, you know, first of all, while there are no U.S. bases in Jordan, there is a heavy U.S. military presence there. And a lot of these missiles that have been shot from Iran, they have been shot down by not just the Jordanians, but also the U.S. presence in Jordan. And Jordan's also trying to reconcile that with the population that's increasingly angry about what's going on, increasingly angry about how Jordan has been handling this situation. And for example, every Friday there used to be a somewhat big demonstration that used to happen in the capital, Amman. But recently that has been, the Jordanian leadership has decided that that wouldn't happen anymore. They've cracked down on these demonstrations, even though they only occurred, I believe, on Fridays. And so there, Jordan has reached a point where it's no longer allowing people to speak about the situation. There are all these laws that are being passed or have passed that say that, you know, speaking about Jordan, and not just Jordan, but like if you speak about, like, let's say the role of the United Arab Emirates, for example, in all of this, or Saudi, then there is a very high possibility that you're going to go to jail, or you're going to be at least, you know, taken for interrogation and whatnot. And this is fueling a lot of, you know, internal, like, domestic fear, but also anger. You know, whenever you talk to anybody in Jordan, you know, you feel that anger. You hear people talking about the fact that they can't support, you know, their Palestinian brethren. And it's not just, you know, Jordanians who are of Palestinian descent, but it's also Jordanians who are, you know, from Jordan, essentially, with no Palestinian background. And so I think, you know, Jordan also has to look at the fact that, you know, Trump has his eye on them. He's, in a way, you know, he's threatened them with cutting down aid, with cutting down money that goes to security. I think they're in a very precarious situation.
I want to pull the lens back a little further and talk about the after effects of the war on Iran. I don't necessarily want to get into the effects in Iran. We've talked about that. We're going to have at least one more episode to come on that. But I think regionally, we're in a moment where it feels like the goal of U.S. policy, of Israeli policy, has become something other than sort of establishing Israel's security and ability to coexist in the region. And now we've moved to Israel has to dominate the region as a hegemonic power. And that's backed, obviously, by the United States. It's not Israel doing that on its own. but it feels like a shift. Is that fair to say in your view? And what does that mean for the rest of the region?
Yeah, I mean, I was reading this piece in the Washington Post, and the headline was something along the lines of Israel, you know, becomes the Middle East's clear hegemon. And it, in a way, that's very accurate because, you know, what started out, honestly, I feel like the starting point was, even though it started long before that, but the starting point was when the beepers incident happened in Lebanon, and essentially that led to, you know, the killing of Hassan Nasrallah and everything that's happened in Syria, the change of leadership, all of that. I mean, it just feels like right now Israel is in a much, much stronger position than it ever was before. And that's saying a lot because Israel has always had the upper hand in the region. I think what's interesting is that, you know, the fact that the U.S. actually struck Iran, you know, it's a major shift from how Trump started his presidency. He called himself a man of peace and a deal maker, but, you know, and then, you know, Trump even went as far as to tell Tehran's 10 million residents to evacuate the city, and all these things. But it just looks that, like, basically Netanyahu and his allies managed to pull Trump into the fight, into a fight that maybe he didn't want to be a part of, by convincing him that Iran is racing toward a nuclear bomb. And that assessment, you know, is not something that everyone in Trump's circle agrees with. But for now, I just feel like, or it seems like Netanyahu is having a moment. He's built it on what his government views as a string of military successes. As I mentioned, you know, a bit ago, you know, Hamas has been severely weakened. Gaza's in ruins. Hezbollah has taken a beating. Syria's pro-Iranian government was toppled. These setbacks have significantly undercut Iran's influence in the region. And at the same time, obviously, they've given Netanyahu more of the upper hand. I mean, he has spent years warning the world, especially the U.S., about Iran. He fought hard against the nuclear deal that limited Iran's ability to build a bomb. And I believe Trump tore up that deal in 2018, partly due to Netanyahu's influence. I think Iran's growing threat has also helped Netanyahu normalize ties with Gulf states like the UAE. But still, critics say he uses the Iran issue to distract from unresolved tensions with Palestinians, millions of whom remain under Israeli occupation. But at the same time, Netanyahu never took his eyes off Tehran, even as Israel waged, you know, the war in Gaza, and that focus has earned him political gains at home. I mean, just a few weeks ago, he narrowly survived a vote that would have toppled his government. And now even some of his fiercest critics are backing him in his war push. So it's not something that, you know, is surprising. I mean, Netanyahu himself said that Israel is shaping a quote unquote different Middle East with strong U.S. backing. So despite its size, Israel's now acting like a dominant regional power. It's flexing its military muscle far and wide with very little pushback. So whatever Trump and Steve Witkoff were trying to achieve with quiet diplomacy seems to have been swept aside by this new military-first strategy.
Where do you think the Gulf Arab states wind up in this new world. It's been for many years, the focus has been on Iran as the great regional threat, and everybody needs to align themselves. The Abraham Accords were facilitated in this way. The push to get the Saudis to normalize, to join those accords and normalize relations with Israel has been shaped around this idea of Iran as this, looming regional power that everybody else needs to band together to resist. That logic has been wiped out. I mean, Iran has been badly handled here. Its regional clients, as you went through the list, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Syrian government, are dropping, one after the other, it seems like. And so now you've got a Middle East where Iran doesn't seem like that much of a threat, but Israel suddenly does. Like, Israel seems like the power that's trying to dominate the region. So what do you think might happen here with, not just the Saudis, who haven't yet made that leap and now say they can't do it? I think before October 7th, Al-Aqsa flood, they might have done this without a Palestinian state, but now say they can't do it without Palestinian statehood. But even the countries that are in, have normalized relations with Israel and now look at a much different Middle East, what do you think, feel like the reaction is going to be from them?
I think if we start off with the UAE, the UAE is not going to change its position. The UAE has made it clear that it's despite some rhetoric, it's very much, aligned with Israel's goals. It's showed that, throughout the war, even despite, the fact that it dispatched some aid here and there, it's spoken a little bit about, the need to preserve the two-state solution. But that all, doesn't really tell us much. It's just for public consumption. Saudi, as you mentioned, is in a different position because Saudi is the one holding out, so to speak, and Trump would like to see Saudi, join the Abrahamic Accords. Of course, we heard a few days ago that there's going to be something new happening with the Accords. There's going to be new states that are going to be joining. I don't know. I can't imagine that it's going to be Saudi. I could be wrong, but I have a feeling it might be Syria again. I'm not sure. But at the end of the day, these Arab states are dropping like flies. And whatever they used to do to kind of like coax their population into accepting, whatever dictatorships they had, it's no longer needing to do that anymore. The entire region has changed. So what just happened isn't just like another round of Middle East conflict, so to speak. I think this is something that could reshape the entire global order. So, and this is another point, which is that if we look at things, if we take a step back, we saw that two nuclear armed states bombed a non-nuclear country that hadn't attacked them. And that sends a clear message to the rest of the world. So if you don't have nukes, you're fair game. And I wouldn't be surprised if more countries start thinking that they need nuclear weapons just to protect themselves. But also the other point I wanted to make is that the broader system of so-called international law, the one that was supposed to prevent exactly this kind of thing, is cracking. So, Israel's attack backed by the U.S., it shows us just how selective these rules are, or how selectively those rules are applied. It also shows how far we've drifted from the idea that international norms can hold powerful countries in check. So in that sense, we're in uncharted territory. What we're witnessing, you know, again, it's not just another conflict, but it's the collapse of a global system and the rise of something much, much darker.
And also, I mean, I wonder about this, but there's got to be some discussion in, you know, among the royal families or the officials, the court officials, the government officials in these countries about, and we don't know what they were saying privately, but publicly, all of the talk was restraint, restraint, restraint. We don't want to see Iran attacked. We don't want this conflict to happen. You know, we're sending messages to Washington saying, you know, hold the Israelis back. Maybe we're sending directly to the Israelis asking them for restraint. None of it had any effect. And I would imagine you start to wonder at that point, like, what am I in this relationship for if I have no influence over any of the other parties and I'm just, you know, supposed to sit here and, you know, kind of accept whatever they do?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, the balance of power in the region has shifted. You had serious collapse. Serious collapse has left Iran with one less ally, and it was a very important ally. And Israel has steadily chipped away at Iran's network of regional partners. So, you know, it's been targeting leaders and weakening groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis. Although the Houthis, excuse me, in Yemen are still active, but they don't pose a large-scale threat. And so Iran is more isolated than ever. And for the Arab states, I think they see that. They see that the region is not static, that it can be changed at Israel's whim and with U.S. support. So whatever whatever hopes they had at the beginning of Trump's presidency, I think that's been wiped out now because, you know, I think a lot of people in the upper echelons of these kingdoms and emirates and what have you, they all thought and firmly believed maybe perhaps that Trump would not act like his predecessors, would leave Iran, you know, out of this and would try to kind of reach some sort of, I mean, you know, I want to say a diplomatic like agreement, but honestly, for me, it was surprising that he actually went ahead and bombed some of these areas in Iran. And I think it may have been a surprise for some of these places, but I think the aftermath was calculated. A lot of, like, for example, Qatar, they were holding talks behind the scenes, I believe, with Iran, and the whole thing about, you know, firing on U.S. bases in Qatar was very much orchestrated. I mean, it was obvious to everybody, especially because the bases were emptied, you know, days or weeks prior. So there's a lot of stuff going on behind closed doors. But at the end of the day, what we know is that, you know, what do we know? The balance of power has changed. Netanyahu's political troubles have been piling up. Despite everything he's done, you know, he has failed to eliminate Hamas. There is rising public frustration over the war in Gaza. His corruption trials are ongoing. But, you know, a war with Iran, that's something that most Israelis do support if you look at the polls. It gave Netanyahu a chance to rally his base, to look strong, to shift attention away from the mounting failures and the scandals plaguing his leadership. But on the global stage, I would say that Israel's war in Gaza is starting to, I don't know if starting, but it's definitely, it's costing costing Israel political capital. More people are calling it what it is, what's happening in Gaza, genocide. And pressure is growing on Israel's allies to explain their complicity. So attacking Iran served as a useful distraction, and it reset the narrative, and, you know, it maybe framed Israel as a defender rather than an aggressor for its own people. So for Netanyahu, it was a strategic win on these fronts. But again, you know, for people on the outside, you're increasingly seeing more and more people seeing Israel for what it is, which is, you know, that it's actually an aggressor.
So that leads, I think, into a final question. I want to bring things back down to the level of what's happening in Gaza. And there is there does seem to be this sense, you know, there's been a number of articles. I think Trump has expressed, you know, kind of indirectly this notion that the attack on Iran, the 2 weeks of this conflict, the amount of damage was done, the fact that the United States jumped in and carried out bombings itself, all feels like a triumphalist moment for Netanyahu. And wouldn't this be a great time to finally say, okay, you know, we've done enough in Gaza. It's time for a ceasefire. I'm very skeptical of this because I don't think he's ready to commit to a full cessation of hostilities indefinitely, whether that's because of domestic politics or because he's just, you know, hasn't gotten tired of killing people. I can't say, but I'm really skeptical of this. I'm curious, as you've seen this narrative start to play out, whether you think there's an actual opening for a real ceasefire in Gaza, not one of these short-term things, not, you know, short-term and then, yeah, sure, we'll get back to you on the, you know, on the long term, and then they never do, or, you know, the negotiations are spoiled from the start. But whether you think there's any opening for a genuine end to Gaza, or if that's, you know, wishful thinking.
I think Netanyahu still has his eye on Iran, honestly. And as long as he's focused on Iran, he's not going to care about Gaza. The fact that he saw that, you know, the political side of countries are doing very much the bare minimum, you know, just issuing, you know, statements of condemnation and whatnot. The fact that he's still able to get away with Gaza means he's going to continue to get away with what he's doing in Gaza. I think that, you know, Iran's nuclear sites, he still has his sights on them. And it's clear that Israel isn't looking to negotiate. I think that Netanyahu is aiming for what he always has called total victory. And that makes, you know, having a new deal with Iran pointless. But also, as long as he's focused on Iran, you know, everything that's happening in Gaza is going to continue to go, you know, down the same path, because ultimately, you know, like, for example, 2 days ago or a few days ago, the EU had an opportunity to not only to slam Israel for what it's been doing in Gaza, but also to, you know, take away the state's abilities to provide Israel with weaponry. And they did not take that chance. They did not want to take that opportunity. And so, you know, despite the fact that, you know, you see all these demonstrations in Europe, you see demonstrations even here in the U.S., the student-led movement and whatnot, and people are getting more and more increasingly frustrated and angry about what's happening in Gaza, especially with all the footage that's coming out, the horrible things that are coming out of Gaza. But at the end of the day, I don't see why this would be enough of a push for Netanyahu to kind of try to get out of the quagmire in Gaza, because at the end of the day, he wants to ensure that not only is Hamas fully toppled, but also he would have an entity in its place that would be completely, you know, supportive of Israel completely, you know, basically doing, you know, whatever Israel dictates. And I don't see that happening right now. Even the Palestinian Authority isn't good enough for Netanyahu for them to take over in Gaza. So I believe he's looking for something even, quote unquote, worse than the Palestinian Authority.
It feels like, I mean, the moment Trump, and this was months ago, but the moment Trump opened the door to ethnic cleansing, like the sky was the limit at that point. Like Netanyahu wasn't going to settle for just any outcome. And he probably won't get ethnic cleansing. I don't know what country would take the Palestinians in and, you know, support that, enable that atrocity to take place. But it opens up so much just in terms of, like, if that's how far the president of the United States is willing to go, then you've got a lot of possibilities for favorable outcomes from Netanyahu's perspective. And he doesn't need to settle for any kind of compromise, it seems like.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as long as he has the U.S., why would he ever settle for anything else? I mean, you know, the truth is that Israel still relies heavily on the U.S. for weapons, for military tech, for diplomatic cover. As you know, Stephen Walt put it, I believe he said something along the lines of a real regional superpower doesn't need someone else to dominate its neighborhood, but Israel does. So at the end of the day, I think, you know, even politicians in Netanyahu's, the Israeli government, or at least, you know, a former Israeli, politicians like, Shlomo Ben Ami, was, you know, saying just a few weeks ago that Netanyahu's confrontational style is partly why Iran's nuclear program is as advanced as it is now. So, you know, and he said that Netanyahu is aiming for the total victory. So at the end of the day, you know, I think the Iran situation is very much tied to the situation in Gaza. And I believe that, you know, in the coming weeks, we're going to see what's going to happen, if the U.S. is going to agree to kind of roll the red carpet for Netanyahu and allow him to do whatever he wants, or whether Trump is going to say, you know, I've had enough. It's very hard to tell with Trump because, you know, I mean, when you have a president that's as fickle as he is, it's hard to tell where he's going to land, really.
The uncertainty is at least not a total down note. So maybe we should end there and just leave it there. But Dalia, thank you so much for coming back to the program. It was a really great conversation. And we hope to have you back again. I hesitate to say under these circumstances, hopefully under better circumstances, but we're always happy to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Even before the Trump administration declared war on higher education, American universities were facing multiple crises, including attacks on free speech from both sides of the political spectrum, battles over the curriculum, and expectations that universities serve as adjudicators of civil rights and social identity claims. Titled The Embattled University, Summer 2025 issue of the journal Social Research and International Quarterly, takes an in-depth look at many of these challenges. It features articles by, among others, Judith Butler on academic freedom and time of destruction, Lisa Anderson on the therapeutic turn in American universities, and David Hollinger on the Republican Party's interest to keep the electorate's level of education low. You can find Social Research at www.socres.org. That's www.socres.org.